On today's show, Team USA blows out Brazil to advance to the semifinals in Paris. LeBron and AD give me reason to believe in the Lakers. We discuss the future of Team USA, and we break down Larry Markkanen's contract extension that will keep him in Utah next season. That and a whole lot more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. With me, as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up, buddy?
Jake, I'm feeling healthy. I'm feeling strong. The skin looks great, as you guys can see on the YouTube audience. The hair, the swoop is happening. There's a lot of good feelings here, not least of which because my work, like for my job yesterday, was just to watch four games of basketball in succession and do nothing else. So pretty good deal.
I did have that thought similarly yesterday as I was sitting on the couch watching game after game after game and thinking, this is a delight. They're 40 minutes. It's over in 2 hours. FIBA is just, I mean, I've thought this since Eurobasket 2022, which sparked my interest to go to the World Cup 2023 and has kept the FIBA flame alive inside me. And I've also, to your point of feeling healthy and strong, not to brag, this is the 11th straight day I've worked out.
Hey,
and I feel phenomenal.
That's really good, man. You should feel you're allowed to brag a little bit about that. That's pretty great. I'm happy for you.
We got really off the wagon during all the playoff and finals and summer league traveling and whatnot. And the diet, you know, had to rein that back in. But last night during pickup, I will say this. I've said a lot about my pickup playing on the show.
You've said a lot about this.
The legs felt good. I was the best defender on the court, which you can't really say too often as a unathletic 6 foot tall white man. So we did it. And the legs are good. And USA's legs looked pretty fucking phenomenal against Brazil in a 122-87 win on, I guess, Tuesday afternoon. It was the nightcap in France of a four-game slate. Like we mentioned, all the quarterfinals took place in Paris, not in Lille. Lille, how do you pronounce it? I don't know because I'm not there.
Lille?
That's funny. I had a good buddy in the NBA coaching world go just for that day. He, in advance, texted me. He was like, we're not going to get to see USA, Brazil, but we're going to get to go to Serbia, Australia, and I'm already drawing a blank. Who did France play?
France played Canada.
France, Canada. There you go. And I was like, dude, I think you're getting the two good games. And that's exactly what turned out. But, I mean, a great game from the Americans who, I mean, their starting lineup finally seems to be finding a groove. Is it as simple as just Joel Embiid has now played two consecutive good games, although now he also has a bit of an ankle issue that kept him out of the first half? Is it more than that? Are they just too powerful and too good for Gui Santos to try to compete with? Like, what any major item A takeaways from this victory here for you, Dan Devine?
Yeah, the biggest one is just, well, if the starting lineup's going to start playing well, then there's no, it's hard to find a seam or a weakness on the team. Like that's been, we talked about it last week, the script through the group stage games was, and through the warm-up games as well, through the tune-up games and the exhibitions, the starting lineup kind of yawns and stretches and stumbles its way, and the opposition is up about a bucket or two. Maybe it's a tie game midway through the quarter. And then Kerr goes to the bench and brings in like the defensive wrecking crew. And then that's the game, basically. And this time it was, I think Brazil held two leads. I believe those leads were 2-0 and 4-2 in this game. And then a 16-2 run. As you mentioned, Embiid, I think it's notable a little bit less. Let's try to feed Embiid on the post a little bit more. Him picking and popping, getting a couple of jumpers to go early, and then that rhythm carrying through. Fewer turnovers, a little bit more. You know, we're playing They were able to play off the front foot in transition, which has been a huge issue for them, a huge benefit to them when they've been able to get stops and play in transition. And Brazil, yeah, just, I mean, they were drawing dead from the jump. There are multiple NBA caliber players or players who have been NBA caliber on that roster, but there's not the collection of talent to be able to withstand any five-man unit, really, for Team USA. And with the exception of a couple of runs that got it to like 8-9, it never felt like there was any real danger there. I mean, shouts out to Bruno Caboclo, shouts out to Marcelinho Huertas in his final game for Brazil at age 41, but you know, not a ton of resistance there. And so, I mean, the big takeaway moving forward, I think, is I'm not sure anybody played more than like 21 or 22 minutes on the USA roster yesterday. So you mentioned Embiid having some ankle issues, or rolled his ankle in the first half. Kerr said, I think he's going to be fine for Serbia. Spoiler alert, it'll be Serbia. And LeBron took an elbow going for a rebound and needed stitches, but expected to be fine. So everybody like minutes down, healthy, fully operational, heading into the medal round with a average margin of victory of like 24 or 25 points. It's basically all you could ask for at this point for Team USA.
Yeah, I think when Embiid hits the first one, sometimes opposing coaching staffs in the league will say, oh, that's good for us, because that means he's just going to keep shooting. And that means the 7'2" guy who's a mammoth on the block with all his Hakeem Olajuwon pivots and up and unders and what have you is going to be standing 30 feet from the basket instead. But when he keeps hitting, then it's like, oh, this is why this guy is one of the greatest scorers in the game and one of the best players in the world. And what do you do with him? And also, this whole roster obviously benefits from the shorter three-point line. But I think Bam and AD and Embiid probably do the most, just being that it's more of in their, you know, those guys are catching at the nail and stuff like that more often than I think the wings and guards on this team. And at that, in this stage, the three-point line is not so much further back from the nail, if you will. And also, yes, another shout out to Bruno Caboclo, which I was waiting all game for Noah Eagle and Dwayne Wade to make the 2 years away from being 2 years away joke. I had my proverbial drink ready. I was ready to take it. And they didn't bring it till like fourth quarter garbage time. But yeah, obligatory comment on Kevin Durant passing Lisa Leslie as the all-time leader in men's or women's Olympic scoring. He's also making his way up. Patty Mills, we'll get to that, did a good job of keeping some distance in the overall all-time Olympic scoring. The Olympics are kind of a funny place where these records get stretched and established all the time. Like, I remember when reading one of our Yahoo push alerts about Simone Biles, it was like, she's the first woman ever to place gold in this event 8 years apart while wearing a red beret. And like, there's all these like,
doing like the basketball reference search strand, and it's like, okay, we're getting a little bit specific on the stat lines where we're counting.
The Thaddeus Young infamous graphic.
That's right. Your search term's a little bit too much, man. You got to dial it back a step or two. Here's a not so obligatory Kevin Durant number. If you're ready for this, he's still coming off the bench, just under 15 points in 20 minutes per game. They're plus 72 in the 78 minutes he's played. That's the highest in the team by far. And his true shooting percentage is 81.6 in this tournament. So like 60% is a really good true shooting percentage in the NBA. And he's at 82. So you mentioned that, you know, who is benefiting most from the three-point line being a step in. Obviously, NBA three-point line, not a problem for Kevin Durant, but also maybe greatest mid-range shooter ever. A step closer for him, pretty helpful as well.
I mean, do you have anything else left to say on this game, or should we kind of shift and funnel all of our analysis here into a preview section? Because to me, like we said at the top, USA-Brazil was the least interesting of the three games. I've got a lot to say on Australia-Serbia. I've got some thoughts on France and Germany. Do you have anything else you want to touch on before we get into that portion of this?
I guess a couple of bullet points. Just Devin Booker leads the team with 18, fourth different leading scorer in the four games for Team USA. Not a surprise given the breadth of talent there, but Devin Booker has been the starting small forward, and that's kind of like, as people have wondered what Tatum's role is on the team, or is, are you going to move Durant back into the starting lineup? Booker just kind of does a little bit of everything. And even though he's undersized to play the three, you know, as a catch and shoot guy, somebody that can be a floor spacer, but also able to be a guard out of the post. Like he does a lot of things really well and fits really neatly into pretty much whatever lineup they put him in. So he's been great there. With Embiid, I thought it was a big deal that on the defensive end, he played maybe, I think, his best overall game, because they were starting to, it's a little bit less of just straight drop coverage with him, a little bit more switching, which that's been the, you know, the way that they've shut off the three-point line with Bam and AD. Embiid doing some more late switching too, able to get out on the perimeter. I know Dwayne Wade was making a big deal about a possession where Embiid was out on a switch and got like crouched down into a defensive stance against a guard. And Wade was like, you kind of love to see that. If you can remove the easy button, like he's in a drop, we come off the screen, pull up jumper, it becomes so much harder to score on Team USA. And obviously it's already pretty damn hard to score on Team USA. And then just LeBron, you know, you mentioned the Olympic records. He's now third all time in assists in the Olympics and second all time in steals in the Olympics. There's only a couple of steals behind Andrei Kirilenko for the all time lead, and a couple of spots behind Sarunas Marcellonis for second in assists. So he continues to be like just quarterback of the team. I mean, you go back, he played in 2008, he played in 2012. He's been he was on the 2004 team that led to the Redeem team, all that kind of stuff. So he, even though he's never been like an overwhelming scorer in the Olympics, he's going to wind up being one of those guys that tops some of those rankings, despite never, maybe, you know, Carmelo got more plaudits in Team USA. Durant will wind up being the leading scorer. But as always, LeBron is kind of the guy that raises the floor for everybody else.
Yeah. I was going to say this at a later portion of our show, but I'll just say it right now. I found myself at one point during the game yesterday, and also in LeBron's quarterbacking against Puerto Rico, that like watching him in this setting to me has validated the Lakers' internal thought process of, dog, we got AD and LeBron, like we got a shot. And they've had, you know, Gabe Vincent's injury stuff last year, and you know, the roster wasn't at full health.
Jared Vanderbilt,
Austin Reeves over the last 2 years has been dealing with, you know, leg and hamstring and whatever stuff. They're like still a move away. They've been patient, right? They didn't go out. They haven't gone out and made the move that, you know, at last year's trade deadline, they were having talks with Atlanta about DeJounte Murray, and there was a first involved and a swap involved and what have you. And then it was all of a sudden like a pull back everything. We're going to have access to three first round picks, including the pick that ended up becoming Dalton Connect. And we're going to do something this offseason. And then they just haven't, outside of using that pick on Dalton Connect and using a second round pick on a certain very, very famous son. And I think there's some dissatisfaction amongst the Lakers fans out there. And it is important to note that, like, the year is very, very early. We've seen plenty of massive trades go down in September the last couple of years. And from a way bigger, you know, see the trees for the forest standpoint, like the rosters around the league won't be complete until the deadline, which there's plenty to get to after breaks and breaks about how Larry Markkanen will no longer be one of those options. But you watch AD have that one ferocious one-handed putback dunk. They got the whole Team USA bench up. He's hitting threes. He's doing defensive stuff. LeBron's doing LeBron things. It's just like, damn. Okay, like I do see the vision. Like I do see if you can find one more dude here, whether it's Jeremy Grant or whether it's someone like, you know, Jonas Valanciunas, who I'm not saying is the guy, but like these are guys that we know were on their list. You know, Clay was clearly a top option there. I think, to be honest, I don't know if there was anyone other than Clay that LeBron would have been willing to take that big pay cut for, you know? So they struck out there. Dallas clearly poses a better, you know, winning scenario. But LeBron and AD. And like, I do believe it. I do. I mean, they got to the conference finals 2 years ago, and I kind of thought it was a fluke, and they barely hung around. They're all close games, but they got swept, blah, blah, blah. Like, LeBron and AD. I am more willing to like go to that church and sit through a service and espouse in the wisdoms than I ever have before.
As long as they stop building the like exact wrong kind of team around LeBron and AD, you get guys who can shoot, guys who can defend, and then let it, the rest of it will figure it out. I understand the point about you need more ball handlers to try to lighten the load on LeBron. Give him guys that can defend, give him guys that can shoot, and chances are you're going to win a lot more games than you lose. So
I hear what you're saying,
but the where is Channing Frye? I mean, he's probably podcasting like us right now, right?
Probably.
Maybe with, you know, I don't know if he's got a better light, you know, lighting setup than I do. I don't know that if the skins, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. I'm not here to, you know, besmirch Channing Frye's regimen. But I think the other thing, though, is just like they are now facing down in Serbia. It's maybe not the biggest threat in the tournament. We can, you know, reasonable people can disagree about that. But when you watch
they
the
being
way,
Team USA, not the LeBron AD Lakers, to be clear.
Yes, sorry, you're right, Team USA. also, like the only American basketball talking person who's not saying us about it, but Team USA. When they go, they take on Serbia now in the semifinal, in the semifinal round. When you watch the way Nikola Jokic closed against Australia, you're like, well, yeah, that's going to be still a pretty big problem. Yes, they've beaten Serbia twice. In, you know, once in an exhibition, once in the Olympic opener, but damn, the way Jokic looked late in that game, you still think that Serbia is going to be a pretty big problem.
Yeah, let's just go right to the close of that game, because to me, we talked about this with J.E. Skeets in our preview, and I was ready to eat a lot of crow with Patty Mills going off in the first half, because I've been saying, dating back to last year's World Cup, and as I talk with Skeets about, as I've talked with fellow Australians, I'm not an Australian. They're fellows to Patty Mills.
Australians, right.
They're fellow to Patty Mills. People around the Boomers program. Like, it's interesting, and this is kind of bleeding into the France-Germany portion later, but like, France, I don't think it's so coincidental that they had more success yesterday against Canada than they've had throughout the entire lead up to this tournament, even dating back to last year when they didn't even make the knockout round in the World Cup by putting Rudy Gobert and Evan Fournier to stage left. Obviously, Fournier came off the bench and played a lot, played closing minutes, hit that huge bomb dagger from damn near half court, but still had a huge reduced role, I would say, compared to the typical he's doing hero ball, just taking high screen action, pulling up and whatever. Like, Australia, they need Patty Mills. They, you know, they're out. We should say that. They lost 95-90 in overtime. I don't think we've said that for sure. So they are done. And to be honest, as we'll talk about after the break about Team USA, I don't know if Patty Mills will even be playing in FIBA play again. Shout out to a FIBA legend. Again, one of the all-time top five leading scorers in Olympics history, was the face, the engine of the team for Australia that placed and won the bronze medal at this tournament in 2021. That was supposed to be the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. But he can't be your engine anymore. He needs to be your secondary creator, flamethrower guy. And while I was adamant about that, and he proved it while shooting absolute blanks in overtime, like, I was texting a coach about this who is connected to the Australian program during the game, and he was like, we don't have anyone better. And I think that's like, it was such a, sometimes these little moments watching a game, texting one person, kind of put on a light bulb for me, putting myself in the chair of certain people in the basketball ecosystem. And I think from the couch, from our microphones and laptops, it's so easy to like wag our finger, particularly at coaching, because everyone thinks that they can just do it on the sidelines and what have you. But like, I think a lot of the calculus that these guys do make who are actually on the sidelines is, well, this is our best option. It's probably not a good one, but it's our best one, to the point right. where even though Patty Mills can stumble and lose the ball and have Nikola Jokic off balance, he can still loft a prayer and it goes in. But then again, like, you get to OT and his first shot is an absolute missile off the backboard. He has two crushing turnovers. And when you have a guy on the other side, such as Nikola Jokic, who can manipulate the entire defense no matter where he is on the floor, and was defending in space like I was at pickup last night. Like, it was awesome. I mean, that is to me what FIBA is all about, because Jokic is playing for nothing other than pride at that point. He has to know that as good as Serbia is, as much as they, even without him last year, made the gold medal game at the World Cup, like, they are an underdog. Everyone who's not having USA across their chest is an underdog in this format. And for him to lay it out there all on the line, you know, the fadeaway bucket to, you know, cap, it was great. But like the defense, the playing in space, getting his hands on things, even, you know, succeeding that Patty Mills prayer. Like, it was awesome to watch one of the game's greatest with the crazy offseason beard make it all happen.
Definitely true. The beard is I think the beard should be a keeper for the Joker. That's just me. Obviously, we're biased toward beards here on No Cap Room. I have a little bit of a harder time wagging my finger at Patty Mills because they're not even.
I'm not wagging my finger. That was kind of a mea culpa of like, I was right, but I also understand where I was wrong type thing.
Probably the best mea culpas are the ones that start with me saying I'm right. Patty Mills goes absolutely ape in the first quarter of that game, in the first half of that game, and builds to the point where Australia has a 24-point lead. They are getting wherever they want on the court in large part because of the way that Mills and then Josh Giddey are just torching the perimeter defense of the Serbians, and they build up this monster lead. And then Serbia cranks up the ball pressure. Alexei Abramovich, or Avramovich, I believe is his name. Really strong perimeter defender, starts cranking up the ball pressure, getting over screens.
A Pat Bev type, if you will.
There you go. And all of a sudden, all of the concerns that Australia's offense had in the group stage start showing up a lot. Like, two turnovers in the first quarter as they built their lead. 18 after the first quarter that I think led to something like 20 or 24 points off turnovers. And it just, you started seeing the even as you mentioned, if your best options are Josh Giddey, just kind of try to create something. Patty Mills, just kind of try to create something. There's not enough sort of creativity in the offense. There's not enough options to penetrate or compromise a setup defense. You can grind into iso ball, you can grind into turnovers, and you can let a team get back on you. Jokic in those last 2.5 minutes, because that's the thing, like, Serbia got all the way back. They were, it was, I think, from 24 down early in the second to 12 down at half to leading after three to up in the closing seconds of the fourth quarter before Patty Mills hits that prayer, as you mentioned. They're down with 2.5 minutes to go. Josh Giddey makes a three. It's 90-87, and Serbia is like, oh, you know, we clawed all the way back. Are we running out of gas? And then Jokic from there, it's like a total takeover in the last 2.5 minutes. Smothers Giddey on a drive. They're deliberately switching him out. Like, we're going to let Jokic guard on the perimeter. Smothers a Giddey drive, blocks his layup at the rim. Guards Patty on a switch, gets beat, but then Patty smokes the layup, and then you can do the FIBA knock the ball off the rim.
Yes.
Jokic does that, knocks it to himself, gets them out in transition. He loses the ball on a post-up, then goes back and steals it from Patty, like goes right back and gets it. Face guarded by Duop Reith, just like shrugs him off, gets a pass along the baseline, little like twirling half hook to give him the lead. Goes like, he's all the way on the other side of the court guarding Giddey on a switch. Shot goes up, it misses. He flies in. Like, I've never seen Jokic fly in for a rebound all the way to the other side of the court to grab the defensive rebound. Like, nobody else is getting the ball right now. Screw this. And then on the other end, as you mentioned, that turnaround, the Sombor shuffle on the baseline, winning play, like whatever that was, like 6 or 7 winning plays in a row from like the 2.5 minute mark of overtime until the final 30 seconds. He did absolutely everything to just seize that game on both ends of the floor. And that is what you need on these stages. Whether the Americans, I mean, LeBron has the capacity to do that. Kevin Durant has the capacity to do that. Remains to be seen if other members of Team USA have the capacity to do that. When you get into the guts of these games, if you don't have that top 5 caliber player in the world and the other guys do, you are at a major disadvantage. And what we saw, even though Australia built up that huge lead, they do not have a guy like that. And frankly, not very many people do.
A couple other thoughts I jotted down quickly, and then we'll move to France and Germany. If there was any doubt why Vasily Micic, Charlotte Hornets point guard, also a veteran of this club and a former EuroLeague MVP, is someone that's been out there as a potential addition to Denver, look no further than how much Nikola Jokic trusted him in the trenches of that game. I want to give a shout out to Dyson Daniels, who really had a strong tournament, from shooting to just having an overall pace and a comfortability, you know, attacking closeouts. And like, once he got past that first level of defense, like, still not feeling rushed, like, had a really good balance, I thought, of when to attack for his own shot, when to keep the ball moving and spray it back out to the perimeter. And, you know, he's known as this defensive wing. Like, Atlanta is super excited. Like, I can't, obviously everyone's excited about the big moves they make right now, but I don't think I can overstate enough how Atlanta thinks Dyson Daniels is, quote, like, the perfect fit next to Trae Young in Quinn Snyder's system. And like, that's known more so for, I think, his perimeter defensive abilities. But like, the dude was fighting for with Jokic for space on the block and had like a pretty nice strip steal on an entry pass to him in one play. And then one last Jokic love for me. Like, so much, it's hard, but so much of appreciating Jokic and Embiid has been comparing the two, unfortunately. Sure. And I just thought it was funny to take note in this game, the little intricacies and the little seconds that Jokic shows, like, his flopping and his like foul baiting is not the same as Embiid's like ripped from Kobe, like, oh, I'm on the block, I'm going to give you a head fake and get in the air type of stuff. Right. They're like quicker. They're like nanosecond. Oh, I see this guy. Like, he caught it at the right block, I want to say, at one point in the second quarter. Don't have the exact time, but like, he saw the hand coming in and just like flicked it up immediately, got fouled. That half court heave at the end of one of the quarters or a half, like, he saw Landell coming and he swung that arm through his own arms. And like, on the broadcast, they're wondering out loud, is this a shooting foul? And like, it could have been, because he found it. And I just, there was one rebound at the end of the game where he figured out exactly how to position his arms again to like get fouled on the literal touch. So it's just brilliance from him in that portion of the game that I don't think he ever really gets highlighted for, that I think is even like a negative sometimes considered for Joel in this whole like never-ending debate between these two guys. But I was just blown away by like those little, oh, I see this out of the corner of my eye, I'm going to get fouled right now. And it doesn't even seem like it's like an effort. It's just like, oh, you are going to put this in front of me, I'm going to eat it now. Like, it was just, it was awesome.
Yeah, they're, I mean, genius level players in a certain understanding, if I push this button, it's going to open this door and then something's going to come out. Like, understanding or reading the chessboard, right? If I move here, it's going to open this up and then that's going to create something else. Jokic may be a little bit more obvious as an orchestrator in that way, but because of the way he is a playmaker with the pass. But and, I mean, the sort of the kinetic version of that, or the physical version of that, that Embiid does, no less impressive, I think, too. So that's going to be it's why Embiid is here to a large extent, is because of this game in a medal round against Serbia to deal with Jokic. And obviously Embiid was pretty quiet in the opener against Serbia. It did not matter. Team USA blew the doors off. But that's sort of the running gag here, is that Jokic played, I think, 31 minutes in that game and they were even, and then got blown up by 26 points in the 9 minutes he sat. Same kind of deal against Australia. I think he was plus 17 in 39 minutes. The 6 minutes he sat, they lost by like 15 or 12 points over the tournament. Plus 43 with him on the floor, I think minus 12 with him off of it. He is probably going to play the whole 40 minutes or damn close to it. So the U.S. has to be sort of aware of that and have some concern about that. One thing that they did well, at least my last like nerdy basketball thought, when Australia was up big, one thing that Coach Pesic, the Serbia's coach, did was try to go a little bit more twin towers, mm-hmm. where it was Jokic and Nikola Milutinov together. And that, like, they were hammering the offensive glass. They were getting second chances. They were getting putbacks. And that was helped tilt the possession game their way. Probably going to be harder to do given just the quality of wings that the U.S. puts on the floor. But I will be interested to see if they decide to go to that and say, like, we're going to try to dictate terms. If you do see either more AD Bam or Embiid with one of AD or Bam as a way to try to deal with that matchup. Of course, the answer to that might just be LeBron play like a center, and maybe that'll be the answer there too. But I thought it was tactically an interesting thing, especially in the other game that we're about to talk about. You went from two bigs to a smaller ball look. When Serbia really needed to crank things up, they went huge, and it did pay off for them.
Yeah, I think for France to have put Rudy Gobert on the bench is like such a and there's been some, you know, Rudy said he had a surgery.
Wait a second. You mean a story around Rudy Gobert is a little bit weirder than it maybe needs to be? That doesn't seem possible. It doesn't seem likely.
Yeah. Head coach Vincent Collier says he was completely cleared to play and it was more tactical and like definitely worked. There was clear.
Yeah.
There was clear clunkiness between the Twin Towers set up for the hosts of this tournament, mostly because I think Victor is not the stretch, you know, five that Cat has been and not Reed has been. That has kind of been the secret sauce in Minnesota. And it's funny how like people try to use some of these things that happen in international play as like indictments of things that happen in these players' actual, you know, day job situations. And they're just not the same circumstances whatsoever when you consider roster fit, you know, location, blah, blah, blah. But I think, you know, I think there's been a bit of a general early anointing of Victor that's a little bit too early, being that on defense, sure, is the guy an absolute freak and a menace? Yes. And like you see everyone from Kelly Olynyk to Jamal Murray seeing him either standing before them or waiting on the weak side. And they're like, I'm not going to go test that guy. But offensively, even in this game where they won, the 19-year-old kid who shoots like 33% from three and does have a flash here too, he's just not capable of driving winning offensively right now. He's just not. And so to have him be more of a complimentary piece and not someone who they're trying to force the ball in certain positions while you have a 7'3" giant block to play with here, I just thought was fascinating. Gershon Yabusele becoming the dancing bear that Celtics fans always imagined. Like, awesome game from him. Isaiah Cordonnier, who I remember the Hawks took in the second round however many moons ago, and seeing him at Summer League and be like, that guy looks fun. Like, he's gotten so much better. Like, the guard play for France is the clear weak spot on their team, which I think was why smart observers thought that Canada was still going to come back and get this thing, because they've got Shea and Jamal and Nembhard and Dylan Brooks and RJ Barrett and go down the line. But they were able to do it. So it'll be interesting against Germany, where they've got Dennis Schroeder and Andreas Obst and Franz Wagner in their, you know, front court that, or backcourt, excuse me, and Franz shifts up and down, whatever. That's just like hungry as shit. Like, I don't think people understand also in America that like Germany could have had Maxi Kleber and Isaiah Hartenstein on this team, but they also just said, no, we did the exact opposite of what Team USA has been doing. We did exactly what Team USA did post 2004 Athens, quote unquote, embarrassment, and said, if you want to be part of this thing, if you want to be part of the 2024 Olympics, we are making a 3-year commitment. They nearly won Eurobasket. They dropped a fourth quarter lead in that they should have had. They come back and just run through an undefeated slate to the World Cup title. And now here they are undefeated again with, I think, a clear, obvious matchup in their favor with a chance to draw the Americans, who, if I remember correctly, I pointed at Germany as the favorite outside of the U.S. when we talk with Skeets. And I don't think it should be a surprise. I think this will be an uphill battle for the host nation. But being at home, the buzz of that home crowd yesterday absolutely played a factor in this win. It wasn't like a college feel. It was like a local high school when you are starting out and you're covering high school. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that joke from last week. When, like, it was like a local high school that all of a sudden is having some success and they're in their state tournament and the whole city, the whole town is rallying around this like mom and pop shop group of boys. You know what I mean? Like, that was what it felt like. And it was awesome. So that will be a big thing behind France's back. But Germany is just a well-oiled machine, man. It didn't matter that they fell down by 12 or so to Giannis and Greece. Like, Giannis was a non-factor in the fourth quarter. Like, they just, they're a full team. They can defend. They know each other's tendencies. Like we talked about in the preview with Skeets. Again, I keep mentioning that, but it just is what it is. Mm-hmm. Dennis just has the exact timing and pick and roll chemistry. It doesn't matter who the big is, if it's Mo, if it's Daniel Tice, if it's Voigtman, and all those guys can step out and shoot threes too. Like, they're just, to me, like a perfect, complete, synergetic international team. And I want that matchup. I want Germany versus USA. That's what I've wanted all along. And I hope we get it. I really do.
Well, we know that Germany can outlast and take down a, you know, B team version of Team USA. We know that in the exhibition slate, they were right there with Team USA until, you know, I think it was only like a 4-point game or something like that. You're absolutely right. The cohesion and the balance of this German roster is absolutely fantastic in terms of the size, the physicality they can play with, the bigs who can shoot, the guards who can penetrate, get into the lane, Franz's ability to move up and down, and, you know, what the ball is getting trapped out of Schroeder's hands. Greece is trying to sell out to avoid what happened to France, where Schroeder is just slicing them apart and getting into the lane. So, okay, he gets off the ball, and now Franz can create, and Franz can get downhill. And there's answers to questions and continuity. And I think it's not an obvious and sort of overwhelmingly simple thing to say, but it struck me as pretty powerful that Dirk Nowitzki, talking to our friend Mark Stein, said, like, this is the golden generation of German basketball. Like, this is the best German national team we've produced. It's the best collection of talent we've had. And obviously, you know, Dirk Nowitzki, famously pretty humble guy, but also famously pretty important on the national stage for Germany. And he's saying, like, this team is better than anything we put out there before. And so I think there, it's, as you mentioned, this is a 3-year run where they're gonna come away with medals in all three international tournaments during this cycle. And it's not guaranteed.
They're guaranteed to play for one.
Yes, I apologize. You're right. They are guaranteed to play for a medal.
Which, by the way, my girlfriend came in at one point while we were watching it, and she was asking me, like, how the medal formats go. And so she kind of misheard me. She was like, that's not fair. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, the loser of the gold medal game should get a chance to play for the silver. I was like, no, they are. Like, that's how that works. Like, these teams are all playing to have a chance to medal. And if you make the title, you do medal no matter what. And then the two losers get to play for bronze. She's like, oh, that's fair. I like that.
All right. I'm glad that it passed muster there. That's good. We all want to be on the same page and have a good feeling moving forward. There was a lot in what you just said. So sort of some stray shout outs as we go along. You mentioned the weirdness over did Rudy Gobert have finger surgery or not? Was he not playing because he, you know, is hurt? It sounds like the answer to it is kind of like, no surgery, yes, injury. Mostly, our offense has kind of sucked and we needed something different. And we wanted to put some energy guys and some hustle against a smaller Canadian team.
Some dancing and bears.
Yeah, Yabusele, fantastic in that regard. Courtney, he was like the only guy that had any juice when they played against Germany. So him getting rewarded for that. And then coming out, I think he had like 10 points in the first 5 minutes.
Juice off the bounce. Like, that's been a big theme of this tournament. The ability to actually have someone who can create off the dribble. It seems like that's fewer and farther between for these non-American teams than you would think at this level.
Yeah. And maybe the answer for France, that help might be coming in the form of like Nolan Traore. And, you know, there's the Wemby wave, as our friend Kristen Peake has called it, is going to start showing up there. And a lot of that youth is front court talent, but if you can get more of the point guards and more of the facilitators, it stands you in good stead in these tournaments. Matthias Lesort, former, I believe, a Sixers draft pick, right?
Beast inside.
That he was, I mean, he drew, I think, 11 fouls. And so, I know there were some Canadian fans that were skeptical of the whistle.
Yeah, maybe some home cooking there.
I mean, listen, they got it, certainly got it against Japan.
That's a wild. That was illegal. All was good. All was good in that Japan game.
I'm just saying, when I watched the Japan game, I was like, this is bullshit. And when I watched the game against Canada, I was like, Canada's getting beat up. And I think there's a difference.
One team wanted it more. One team was playing to rip the win away. The other was playing to not lose it. That felt very clear to me through the screen.
And I think we need to talk a little bit about Canada there. I mean, as you mentioned, France-Germany is going to be, I think it's a fascinating game because I believe Germany is a better team. And I believe, that France has the home court advantage. I also thought that about Canada. And this is like zoom out to the macro level. And it's.
Yeah, let's give a Canada a bit and then we'll take a break.
Yeah. Is that this, first Olympic appearance in, I believe, 24 years for the Canadian men's team. They are coming off of the bronze in the World Cup. They get to the knockout stage, like broadly successful, right? But for them to get punched in the mouth the way they did, I think they were down 17-5 kind of before they even got out of bed. And for their offense to be so just anemic, where I think it was 3 made shots and 7 turnovers in the first quarter. They absolutely got muscled up by France and did not have an answer offensively. They didn't have an answer offensively anywhere for the rest of the game that wasn't Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who was phenomenal and who basically through force of will got them to within a couple of buckets late, 2 possessions. I think it was a 5-point game after a Lou Dort pick 6 and a steal and scoop and score. But the big unfortunate takeaway here, outside of you just need more size, you're playing 4 wings, you're playing Dylan Brooks at power forward, you're playing having Dylan Brooks guard Wembanyama, and then all those other wings are getting sort of posted up by Yabusele, they're getting blown by Cordonnier, they're getting beat up on the inside on switches by Lesort. The thought process of this team was, well, when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander rests, Jamal Murray comes in. And we have 2 world-class creators.
Oh, yeah.
And man, Jamal Murray made the way he looked both throughout the tournament and in this game, I think if you are a fan of the Denver Nuggets, and if you are maybe somebody in the Denver Nuggets front office who is about to tender him an extension offer for, I don't know, 4 years and $208 million or something like that, you probably have a lot more reservations about that today than you maybe did 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's been one of the elephants in the room of the NBA offseason. It's that there was reporting on draft night, whenever it was, that Denver and Jamal were nearing a massive extension agreement. And just like by all accounts, from my understanding, that is just not the case. That there's tricky things to discuss on both sides. I think overall, the depth behind Jamal, that resulted in Reggie Jackson playing 82 games last year and Denver sending 3 seconds to get off of him and they bring in Russ. And there's still this talk of, what other potential backup point guard options can they bring in? A lot of that has been because of internal trepidation, I'll say, about Jamal's injury status over the last couple of years. But like, the dude, when healthy, when right, has just been an absolute animal. I mean, think about him with those game winners against the Lakers in the first round. And as much as Jokic did his thing with Serbia, with Micic, like, I definitely had a couple of thoughts of like, man, if Jamal Murray was out there, this would be a wrap. Because those guys just know how to tango together. But yeah, I think...
Not if Jamal Murray's shooting like 28% from the floor.
Exactly. Overall, since they won the title, I think Jamal Murray's stock has been overall down. And that is not what you would like if you are Denver having to have these conversations. We'll talk about it again after these breaks here. But like Utah just lavished Larry Markkanen with a 5-year, $200-plus million deal. But we are not going to be seeing second guys. Right now, Utah's paying Lowry as their, you know, franchise face, which he is. He is their all-star. He is their clear-cut best player. He is someone that they're hoping to add to. But if you're Jamal Murray, if you're Brandon Ingram, if you're Karl Anthony Towns on his next contract, if you're Michael Porter Jr., you know, Tobias Harris's deal that came off the books in Philly, that's a deal that people don't want to replicate. And it's going to be even harder now, I think, for teams to swallow the pill of $200+ million for guys that they don't necessarily think are, without a doubt, the first option on a championship team if needed to be called upon, like that 1B type of player. And it's just going to be something I admittedly haven't talked with Nuggets folks about this in a couple of weeks, like since Vegas. But what happens on that extension conversation between now and the season starting is going to be, I think, one of the more intriguing and one of the more important in terms of like a contender, a team that just won it, like a team that has had stability and continuity, like how Denver moves forward with Jamal Murray in that extension is going to have massive ripple effects around the league, I think. And with that, we are going to take a quick break for some ads and be right back with more No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room, where we are in between days of the knockout rounds of the men's basketball tournament in the Olympics. And Dan, by next week, we'll be done with the Olympics. The finals will be Saturday. And it will be time to turn the page to Los Angeles in 2028. So quickly here, because we have some news to touch on in our everyone's favorite segment, Five Out. Who of this team, I mean, are we expect, like, to me, Anthony Edwards, Tyrese Haliburton are probably the runaway favorites to be on that 2028 club. Then you've got Tatum and Booker, I think, are still going to be clearly in the age range. Bam will be only 31 by then, but probably out. And who knows at the rate that he's still going. LeBron, Steph, Durant, Embiid, Derek White will be well beyond 30 at that point. Drew Holiday will be 38. Anthony Davis will be 35. I don't know. Who are some players that come to mind for you that you will be looking at for the 2028 Team USA outfit in Los Angeles?
So I think it's interesting because you're projecting out, you know, young stars going forward, right? There are some that have already had some connection to the program, like Donovan Mitchell was on the 2019 World Cup team. They fell short, but I think he's only going to be 31 or 32 around then, so should still be in the age range there. I kind of love the idea of like 43-year-old full gray LeBron, but I don't think we're going to get that.
What if we do? What if he's still playing for the Lakers? What if him and Bronny are still doing it for the hometown LA? And
it's the ultimate opportunity. That's pretty impressive. I like that idea a lot. Ja Morant and Zion Williamson are interesting because talent-wise, you could absolutely see them being focal points and centerpieces of the program moving forward. Obviously, injuries and then in Ja Morant's case, some off the court stuff have raised their heads over the last couple of years. But if those guys are healthy and, you know, remain their stars, remain on the ascent the next couple of years, would make a ton of sense. I think Zion as a FIBA big is a really interesting thought experiment. I'm not so sure about that. Chet Holmgren was on the select team. I think he makes a ton of sense. You're talking about rim protection and shooting, playmaking bigs. Obviously very thin there, but, you know, in 4 years, he'll probably put on some weight. Derek Lively as another center there, you know, FIBA big. He's maybe not the shooter, although we saw during the finals, he made one. And, you know, maybe they'll have him shooting more in Dallas. But the idea of big, switchable rim protector, can make plays on the move, all that kind of stuff, feels like he makes a bunch of sense there. And I think a lot of it then is sort of projecting the next few draft classes or most recent ones. And that's a little bit tricky, but Cooper Flagg obviously was the name on everybody's lips coming out of the select team this past season. Last year, Cade Cunningham was that guy, and he, you know, wound his way through another dismal season in Detroit, but his star could be on the rise. you're talking about in the next, you know, other projected high draft picks in the next couple of years, like Flagg, like Ace Bailey and Dylan Harper, the guys at Rutgers, AJ DeBanta.
I'm going to say anyone who has not been drafted in the league right now, I don't think they're going to be competing with Scotty Barnes and Paolo Banchero and Jalen Brunson and even guys like Brandon Miller, who were on this select team, and Trey Murphy and Keegan Murray, and the Thompson twins are like the perfect kind of front court guy. So I don't want to pour cold water on what's supposed to be a very, very talented rookie class. And while I would say yes to Cooper Flagg, those dudes are going to have to be phenomenal, I think, to supersede NBA players who have real connections to this program. Like even, you know, Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart, who were probably two of the most beloved players on the World Cup team by the coaching staff, let alone their teammates. And Team USA is a program that really does call back to guys who have, you know, participated in the past and done things for the program, and the three letters on their chest and not the letters on the back, blah, blah, blah.
Let me ask you, well, first off, as speaking of a place of ignorance, so maybe you know better than me, is this coaching staff, or roughly this coaching staff, expected to continue? Like, is Steve Kerr expected to be the coach in 28?
I mean, I haven't checked that as up to date today, but
I'm not asking you for insider.
Yeah, like, I'd be very surprised. This is pretty typically a 4-year cycle thing. This will be the end of that cycle. The next coach likely will be decided, but like, could be Spoelstra. He's been an assistant. Kerr was an assistant before him. So it could be Mark Few. Like, it could be anyone who's been attached to this program in the past.
So the part where like Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart were beloved performers, and I think there was probably a lot of positive things to say about Donovan Mitchell from those World Cup teams too. There's also the point of like, those guys were beloved members of teams that underperformed and didn't medal at their respective competitions. And so like them and Brunson, you know, did they wind up getting tarred?
So was LeBron in 04, man.
Yes. Order of magnitude different, maybe a little bit, but I hear what you're saying. I'm not saying this to troll. I'm saying it because I'm interested and I don't know.
Troll me.
Past performer, somebody who has devoted time and energy for the cause, who's going to be prime age in four, still around prime age in 4 years. Does Jaylen Brown get a call? Would Jaylen Brown take the call if he gets one from Grant Hill at that point?
If we're talking about mea culpas, that'd be a nice bow on that story for sure.
So here's my question. Who's the one saying they're sorry?
They probably both are. I don't know.
I mean, that's usually the way it works out. Reconciling does require both people to be a little bit humble. Also, I just got to say it. Tyrese Maxey, Captain America. Where, you know, why not us? Why couldn't that be? And I don't know if he'll be the same level of athlete in 4 years, but both of us have been saying, why can't Aaron Gordon be on this team for like a year and a half? I don't know. Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon 2028. Let's get it. Let's make it happen.
There we go. Well, if you can't get enough Team USA, let's hope you can keep envisioning who will be on this team for the next 4 years, just like
Donovan Klingon, Stephen Cass. Let's just say some more names. Reed Shepard. Let's get the names out there, everybody. Let's keep this going. Hashtag Team USA 2028 at Jake L. Fisher. You got to reach out to him. You got to get it going. We got to talk about it now. We got to get this started.
Let's take another ad break and then hit five out, five new segments from around the NBA. And we are back on No Cap Room with five more topics to discuss. The first, the most important of August, the thing the entire NBA world has been waiting for, Larry Markkanen has officially signed a 5-year, $238 million renegotiation and extension contract with Utah today, Wednesday, August 7th, which means he will not be trade eligible for the entire 24-25 season because he is not eligible to be traded for 6 months. And 6 months from now happens to be February 7th, which, Dan, is what?
The day after the 2025 trade deadline.
Which also, all this stuff means that he will not be a free agent come 2025, which we saw this last summer, this past couple of weeks. Not really a robust market in terms of guys who were on the open market, available for the taking, and willing to change teams. I think the most important thing I wanted to discuss about this here, because we've spilled a lot of ink on yahoosports.com. We wrote about this on Monday and gave kind of a full accounting for anyone who needs more info about what brought us here, all the trade talks that came and went for Lowry between Golden State and Sacramento and San Antonio and other teams on the periphery and what have you. I think the thing I saw the most online in reaction and response to my story on Monday was, why are the Jazz doing this when we need to tank for Cooper Flagg? And I just want to, you know, don't shoot the messenger, but the Western Conference is going to be absolutely loaded next year. And as great as Larry Markkanen is, as much as he hasn't really had a full offseason because in a couple years, because last year, people may forget, and the years before that, he had to do like mandatory conscription stuff for the Finland and Finnish army. Like he was taking selfies with like war paint on his face and stuff like that. He just, shout out Larry, he's the man. But healthy now, those pictures that Utah posted, sending a couple of coaches and Keontae George out to work out with him, looking absolutely shredded. And people I know who have been on the ground, who have seen Larry, have been like, yeah, this dude is shredded. Like, it's not just the camera showing you things. The Jazz aren't going to be good enough to compete for a position that's going to, outside of lottery luck or misfortune, like their pick is top 10 protected to Oklahoma City from a pass trade. It's going to be, I think, a really, like, things would have to go pretty perfect from a winning standpoint for Utah to be in danger zone of that not happening. As good as Larry is, there's going to be 7 first round picks in the last couple of years on this roster. Like, as good as Keontae George has shown progress, like they're trying to move off of guys like Jordan Clarkson and John Collins. And yes, like Danny Ainge in Boston, when they were tanking along the side of the process Sixers and other teams, and all of a sudden he just made a trade for Isaiah Thomas and they're back in the playoffs. Will they be opportunistic as they were trying to be this summer? You know, they tried to trade for Mikal Bridges. They've been in talks with the Atlanta guys about the 2 point guards there before DeJounte got moved to New Orleans. They were hoping to get people in the door and then say, hey, Paul George, we have a big 3. You want to make it a big 4? They didn't. So I would not be so alarmed if I'm a Jazz fan that paying Larry and rewarding him and being like, we're going to build around this guy, even though they have the optionality, all the picks to go in and trade for anyone if they want to. I am still at this point, it seems way more likely than not that Utah is going to be in prime position to get that pick and have a chance at the number one pick and Cooper Flagg come May 2025.
Yeah. Real quick, 2 notes there is that even with Lowry Markkanen on the court, and as good as Lowry Markkanen is, in his minutes last year, the Jazz outscored opponents by 0.2 points per 100 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass. That is about a 41 win team, about a 500 mark there if you're playing even. With him off the floor, they got outscored by 10.7 points per 100. So unless everything gets better across the board and he plays like 47 minutes a game, they're probably going to be like, if you're a 500 team with your best guy on the floor and you're like a 17 win team with him off, the average there does put you somewhere around like 30, maybe high 20s, low 30s. And with the flattened lottery odds and everything else we've seen, that's plenty bad enough to be good enough to get where you want to go. So there's no such thing as a guarantee of a number one pick in this league. But yeah, I think you're right to say that securing one piece of your future and then providing ample opportunity for the other pieces of your future to grow and take their knocks in real time does not necessarily preclude the Utah Jazz from being in the running for what the major prize that they're looking for.
And all the young dudes will get better playing with someone like Larry, to your point of the on-off splits. The other thing that's definitely taken a lot, and this is item 2 of our 5 outs segment now, being that the Warriors, of course, were very interested. And there's plenty of reporting from myself and others that Utah prioritized Brandon Pajemski, the sophomore guard that is projected to start for Golden State this season, instead of Jonathan Kuminga as like the quote unquote blue chip prospect back. And what I want to say to that is this is the item 2 of our 5 out here. I think that is just as much of the extension numbers that Jonathan Kuminga would like than it is about anything that these two guys have done on the floor. Pods is going to be entering year 2 of a 4-year rookie deal. Jonathan Kuminga is entering the final year of his rookie deal, where the word around the league from various sources is that Kuminga and his representation are looking for a full max extension, which, as we just talked about with B.I. and Jamal Murray and whoever, like, if you're not absolute all-star Scotty Barnes type of guy for Toronto, Larry Markkanen for Utah, you know, Trae Young for Atlanta back in the day, because look at what happened to Trae Young in Atlanta since then. It's really hard to get that number. And that's what the agent has to do in that scenario. That's what we're going to talk about. An item, and I'll bring it up now too. Like in Atlanta, item three of our five out, that, according to my information, is what Jalen Johnson is hoping for with the Hawks in his extension, and what Clutch Sports should be asking for as well. Like, that's just what good agenting is. But to bring this back to Golden State, like, the numbers that run underneath all these team building decisions, a lot of them are accounting for money that's going to be coming onto your books in the future, and how do we prepare ourselves for that now while still maintaining our competitiveness on the floor today. And so for Golden State, like, Kuminga was their third best player last year behind Draymond and Steph. I think that's pretty objective. And on both sides of the floor, he took massive, massive strides come the turn of the calendar, where he had like a whole stretch of 20-point games in a row and all that type of stuff. And they are trusting him more in that pinch post spot to give him opportunities to play make out of there. But there's no way he's proven to Golden State personnel that he's worth that money right now. He definitely hasn't proven it to Utah. And if you're trading for, if you're trading Larry Markkanen for someone like him, knowing that he wants that, you kind of have to be willing to pay it. And I think that was a big piece of this puzzle that I don't know if has been fully illustrated and underscored to this point.
I just find myself thinking, it's clear that the Warriors haven't either, they haven't seen what they would need to see to be comfortable making that kind of commitment, or they're not seeing what they want as a, on a baseline level in terms of how to operate within Steve Kerr's system or whatever, because they just haven't given Kuminga the keys really in that way. Right.
Or made the playoffs and have him been in like a real winning or been a winning team. Like, sure, their record, like, you know, whatever, like they could have in the East, blah, blah, blah. But like, they haven't been there yet because of his play.
And that manifested last season in some boiling over into the public eye of frustrations between with Kuminga. So basically, the reporting being that he was eager for some kind of change, either to start or something.
Yeah. And that's been smoothed over, though. Like, I will say that happened like mid-January, I think, early January. By trade deadline time, when I was following Golden State for the weekend, I sat down with him. Like, him and Kerr had a really good man-to-man, eye-to-eye conversation that, like, definitely a big point of that was, hey, let's handle this stuff in-house instead of leaking that to the press. And I think overall, like, there's a general positive arrow on Jonathan Kuminga within the walls of Golden State, just not positive to the point of that type of money yet.
Right. To hear, you know, here's $50 million a year or $40 million a year or whatever it wind up being. I just, at some point, there needs to be a decision of, are we in on this or are we not in on this? Right. And if they are not comfortable with whatever the number is going to wind up being for him, and he's not comfortable with whatever the number is that they are comfortable with, a pretty simple line to draw is like, well, then what is the market for Jonathan Kuminga out there in the world? And I think that's if what we're hearing out of Utah is we'd rather, and it makes sense from a cost control perspective, you know, you don't have to make that decision on Brandon Pajemski yet, yada, yada, yada. If it's like, well, we view Pajemski as a higher end asset because of that control, these years of control, and Kuminga being closer to where he's going to get paid, where that place is for him, I think, is a really interesting question, because I think there's a lot of teams that have, you know, combo fours that they like a lot, and there aren't as many of those where, you know, like, you could have made, it would have made sense at some point to be like, well, maybe you draw a line from him to Indiana, but then they went and they got Pascal Siakam and they,
yes, which they, you know, signed. I mean, him. That was definitely a thing that was discussed back 2023, whenever. Yeah, 23, when they picked Jairus Walker and they were there. Like, that was definitely a conversation that was had.
But in any event, so Kuminga's an interesting guy because the you see the flashes, you've seen now a more extended run of production, but what the price point winds up being and who winds up being interested in footing that bill, I think will be something worth keeping an eye on, because this is all unfolding in an environment where Klay Thompson just walked out the door. Steph Curry, you are playing with the last few years of Steph Curry's prime. There's the Draymond Green question moving forward. Like, there's a lot of stuff still to get figured out in Golden State. And Kuminga seems like he's going to be a pretty big part of that.
Yeah, and he'll get to play out this whole year. He'll get to go to restricted free agency. This is not to, you know, spell doomsday and illustrate this as like a massive staring contest and, you know, issues to come. It's just, it's early. And just like in Atlanta with Jalen Johnson, like, the Hawks made basically everyone available for trade since February besides him.
Except him, right.
So, like, of course you're going to be thinking, well, then pay me that way. But the guy has had his own injury history, hasn't put together a full season yet. For all the promise that made me want to fly down to Atlanta and profile him, and you can read a really, you know, vulnerable story on yahoosports.com from him talking about all of his mental health issues that he had at Duke during COVID and what have you. Like, it's going to be a prove it year in terms of dollar figure for him as well in this new iteration where they put Dyson Daniels in the spot of DeJounte Murray, and they incorporate the number one pick in this draft of the Wemby wave, Zachary Risacher, and they try to figure out where Atlanta can find themselves somewhere between, you know, the Orlandos and the, and I can't even put the Indianas because they made the fucking Eastern Conference Finals, but you know, the Orlandos and the other teams that have been in that 7-11 muck, you know, not the Washingtons, not the Charlottes, you know, that type, not the Detroits. Like, can Atlanta figure out an identity that is successful? How much of that Jalen Johnson is responsible for will absolutely directly result in his dollar figure that he comes to, just like Kuminga's as well.
You got anything more to say to me about another guy named Jalen and his recent contract situation that may or may not have included a wink, wink, nudge, nudge about something else that happened this week?
Item four of our five out, Jalen Brunson, the first New York captain in 6 years since
Lance Thomas, ladies and gentlemen. So that's how you know it's a prestigious award.
Lance Thomas was like the Nick for a while, though.
Which I say that no disrespect to Lance Thomas, who, yes, served admirably in a time of great turmoil. But that Lance Thomas was the Nick for a minute is maybe a greater indication of what the nature of that Knicks team was for a while.
So was Todd
maybe
Gibson.
It was also just like, this will get us in good with the Duke Mafia. I don't know. Hard to say. But Jalen Brunson named the first Knicks captain in 6 years. 36th captain in franchise history. Jake, go ahead and name them all. I will say previous captains have included several Hall of Famers. Dick McGuire, Carl Braun, or maybe Brown. I mean, you know, Christian Brown is messing with my head. I think it's Carl Braun. Willis Reed, Earl the Pearl Monroe, Bernard King, and Patrick Ewing. Also legend, but not Hall of Famer, Charles Oakley, who I believe served two separate stints as the captain of the New York Knicks.
Every time I hear a list of New York Knicks greats, I think of that scene early in Eddie where she's going through her closet and deciding what jersey to go. And she finally finds number 15 and goes, Monroe!
There you go, Earl the Pearl.
Eddie's a good one. I should watch.
Goldberg, shockingly not past Knicks, not one of the 36, not a past Knicks captain, maybe an honorary captain.
I also
at some
don't
point.
Think she's in good standing in current cancel culture, but I don't really know. I haven't watched The View ever. So,
you know what? I can't speak intelligently about that. Certainly not as intelligently as I speak.
But I
want to
watch Eddie
that...
now. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I'm sure it's good on a rewatch under certain circumstances.
I'm sure it is under certain circumstances. I wonder what those circumstances are. I will just say this. If you were worried that Jalen Brunson's path to New York City royalty was insufficially Jeterian or Jeter-esque, him getting named the captain of the team. Yeah, him getting named the captain of the team feels like another step in that path.
I don't know. Jalen Brunson, number 11, 1 + 1 = 2.
There you go. I mean, listen, we're doing our mathematics here on No Cap Room. the thing that I would say is if I'm just imagining the negotiation where it's like, all right, I'll take the $37 million haircut over the next 3 years, but you got to make me the captain. And I don't know if it was
the captain
hard.
Now.
Exactly right. It was Captain Phillips, Captain Brunson. Now he's got to get Tom Hanks in here to recreate the scene. But congratulations to all the Brunsons and all the Rosies and all the other families involved there.
He would recreate a Tom Hanks scene just as him and Tyrese Halliburton were heels and faces in WWE. But let's get out of here after this final note of five out. Charles Barkley, I think people were kind of expecting this who were in the know, changes his mind. He will not retire after the season. And there was a joint statement that reaffirmed his long-term commitment to TNT Sports, where TNT is now reportedly considering turning Inside the NBA into Inside Sports and having the guys have more of a variety show and just talk more NBA, which, you know, is great because Kenny and Chuck are just so knowledgeable whenever they take the NCAA March Madness desk. So I'd be happy to hear anything about NFL. You know, I am remiss. I should have said at the top, you know, Brazil makes me think about the Eagles starting week one on the road in Brazil, September 6th, whatever that Friday night is. Peacock, get your TVs ready. But yeah, Charles Barkley is not going anywhere. Like I've kind of said, like, don't cry for Inside the NBA where they make $20 million and they're going to be fine.
Yeah, so he's in the third season of a 10-year, $210 million contract. And so he's not going anywhere because he has 7 years and hundreds of millions of dollars left to earn there. There's a great line from a piece by my friend Brian Curtis, from a former colleague at The Ringer, from when Charles started wondering aloud about free agency. And he said, quote, maybe Barkley thinks a lot about going fishing. He can be moving when he talks about the physical toll of basketball on ex-players. But it's also true that every time Barkley mentions retirement, someone pays him to keep working. And the idea of walking away from $210 million deal to keep making shows where you kind of almost don't have to really watch the thing that you're talking about doesn't necessarily seem like it would be good to walk away from that. The idea of, as you mentioned, Andrew Marchand at The Athletic had wrote that he's expected to still be part of the NCAA tournament coverage. It could explore opportunities with other properties, including the NHL. And other reports of, I think, Wall Street Journal said it could also include Major League Baseball. I don't know how much. I mean, the idea is generally, I mean, basically, Charles Barkley is, yes, he's a basketball commentator, but Charles Barkley is just a famous guy who's a fun person to listen to on TV. So let's have him talk about other things. I think the thing that's, and we'll see how successful or whatever, they've tried to have Charles Barkley be like a cultural commentator beyond Inside the NBA, where he made that like documentary, American Race, in 2017.
Yeah,
the
one that has like CNN every so often.
Yeah, it was the, like, I remember it mostly as the meme of the poster that said, we're going to start a dialogue. Yes. He had a show with Gayle King talking about politics and cultural matters too. So like, I think they continue to look at him and they're like, well, yeah, Kenny and Shaq and Ernie will figure out, but like, he's a celebrity. So like, yeah, maybe we'll just make him more of a celebrity in other areas and pay, you know, through the nose to do it. So whether it means Inside the NBA, whether it means they do a variety show about other sports, whether it means Charles commentating on hockey, I don't know. But yeah, I don't think we're going to be in danger of him not being on our televisions or screens in some capacity over the next several years while he makes $210 million. I think that's going to keep going.
Well, if that's the tried and true formula, I'm going to take a moment here to announce I am considering retiring from NBA coverage after the 2024-2025 season. It's been a good ride.
We are going to start a dialogue.
That is it for us today. I'm retiring from this episode of No Cap Room. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. It'd be much appreciated. We thank you for listening and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.
Evan Mobley and Casein Wallace could also be on the 2028 USA team.